equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon, I'm Carl Ettenayer, today's host for Equal Time Radio, and as usual on Mondays, my theme is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. Got a blog called Relocalizing Vermont, which takes up the same themes. It's at the Vermont Commons website, vtcommons.org/blog, or just go to vtcommons.org and click on the blog link. An audio of these shows is posted usually the next afternoon at equaltimeradio.com. Got a great show coming up for you today. Mark Krawcheck is going to talk about converting lawns to food gardens, why to do it, how to do it, and things to watch out for. Mark runs Keyline Vermont, which is a permaculture design and consulting business. And in the second half of the show, we'll be talking with George Schenck. He's the founder and CEO of American Flatbread. He'll talk about creating a new legal framework for Vermont food, including how to make local food more affordable. But first, I want to tell you a couple things. One, a story of commuting follies, the story of how I ended up not quite sure how I'm going to get home tonight. It's a story that shows the difficulty of trying to change your routine just a little. You know, I have this overall project of getting around Vermont without the use of my private car, and I'm not extreme about it. I still own a private car. Have spent most of my adult life not owning one, but at the moment I have one. And I've shared stories with WDEV listeners about how I've done this, and I've even got a ride last year about this time from one of them to Burlington after a show, just by saying, I want to go to Burlington, anybody heading that way? And now I'm in a nice routine for my Monday shows here on WDEV. I bike down to Montpelier. It's about 4 miles, a little less, and 700 feet of drop, so easy bike to do early in the morning. And then Jack Donovan, he picks me up in Montpelier on his way to the station. He leaves later than the bus does, so I get to be at home, work there a little longer. And then I work at the station for the rest of the morning. After the show, I work some more at the station, and I take the 3:30 bus back to Montpelier, where I get my bike and ride it home. Easy. Today, my wife dropped me off at the studio on her way to Burlington. And I did the same thing with her last week, and it worked out well. She did an errand in East Montpelier with her car. I rode my bike to Montpelier, and she picked me up there and took me to Waterbury. No problem. So today, I thought, I'm doing the same thing. No problem. So I have this bike bag packed full of my clothes for biking back up the hill. I change into some clothes I don't feel bad about sweating in going up the hill. It's got bike tools and so on. There's one flaw in my plan, though. My wife didn't have an errand in East Montpelier Village this morning, so we left home together in her car. When I got to the studio, it finally occurred to me to ask, you know, where does that leave me when I get back to Montpelier? My bike's at home. I didn't ride it down to Montpelier to meet her, as I usually meet Jack. So I've got this bag full of biking gear and no bicycle. But maybe I'll find the solution at the Vermont Film Festival. That's going strong through Sunday, as I'm sure you know, in Montpelier at the Savoy Theater, and they've got another theater set up in City Hall, as they usually do. This is the 12th annual Green Mountain Film Festival. And I went to 3 films over the weekend. They were all good, and they were all sold out. One that stuck with me the most was Let the Right One In. It's a Swedish movie. It's about a boy 12 years old who meets a girl his age. She moves in next door. It's pretty much your standard boy meets girl, girl turns out to be a vampire type of movie, which is to say kind of unusual, but very well made. Tonight, the WDEV film is going to be showing. Tune in tomorrow. So if you haven't seen it on Vermont Public Television yet, I hear it's been shown a lot. I haven't seen it on public television. Then here's your chance. Maybe, I don't know whether it's sold out or not, but if you go to greenmountainfilmfestival.org, you can maybe find out. And there are going to be some WDEV luminaries scheduled to be there afterwards for a discussion, which I'll sit back and listen to. So maybe I'll see a neighbor at the film who'll be willing to give me a ride homeward when the discussion is over. Or maybe I'll walk and hitchhike. It's not that far out of town, even if I end up walking the whole way. Anyway, I'm so pleased with my plans to get around Vermont using my own, without using my own private car, work out well. I figure it's only fair to tell you also when the plans go awry. Also wanted to tell you a little bit about solar cooking. I mentioned that last week. Talked about my opening up the solar cooking season. And after I talked to you, I made the best chicken dish I've ever made. in the solar cooker, and then I managed to screw up the recipe the next time I made it. But that takes a little time to tell, and I want to get to our first guest here, so I'll try to remember to talk about that next week. Well, gardening is on the rise right now. Nationally, a recent survey conducted by the National Gardening Association, according to this article I found in, I found it online. It's a newspaper in Staunton, Virginia, called The News Leader, which I don't normally read, but I did find this article. The National Gardening Association study confirms that vegetable gardening in the U.S. is on the rise. Officials with the organization say they expect 7 million more kitchen gardens in 2009, which is up 19% from 2008. This anticipated increase, the article says, is nearly double the 10% growth in vegetable gardening activity from 2007 to 2008, as more people seek to grow their own food. So not only is it's growing faster each year, at least over the last couple of years. We'll see how long that accelerated trend continues. Times Argus had an article recently. Big seed company like Burpee reports running out of seeds for basics like tomatoes and onions. Locally, Highmoing Organic Seeds in Hardwick is reporting booming sales. And Elmore Roots in, well, Elmore. I talked to David Freed the other day. He's the owner of it. And he taught a course on just a little workshop in the evening at the Kellogg Hubbard Library last week on growing small fruit like blueberries and so on. He expected 8 to 10 people. 65 people showed up. He was telling me with amazement that people were showing up 20 minutes early to make sure they got a seat. Big demand for gardening here in Vermont and nationally. So if you are a new gardening wannabe, where are you going to find the land? For a lot of people, it's their lawn. We have with us on the phone today a local expert on converting lawns to gardens, Mark Krawczyk. He runs Keyline Vermont, a permaculture design and consulting business. He's been on the show before talking about permaculture. Mark, welcome back to Equal Time.
Thanks, Carl. It's great to speak with you.
So, you know, I was going to begin the show by asking, why would people want to convert their lawns to gardens? But, you know, if 20% more kitchen gardens are going in this year than last year, and last year was 10% above the year before, I think a lot of people know already why they would want to do that. But why don't you tell us the basics for people who maybe haven't thought it through so much?
Sure, definitely. And I just wanted to say that, you know, it's really exciting and encouraging to see how many people are starting to come around and realize the value of you know, backyard food production. And it's unfortunate that in many cases it's almost the result of necessity. But nonetheless, I guess the primary reasons, I tend to break them down just in terms of resource consumption and at least in a very physical sense. In terms of cost, water use, chemicals that are required for maintenance, and then overall energy use. I have some statistics that are pretty staggering. Every weekend, they estimate there's between about 55 million Americans that mow their lawns, which uses up about 800 million gallons of gas per year. And what follows from that is that actually, generally most power mowers, most gasoline-powered mowers, are much more polluting than the internal combustion engine in vehicles, so that a single hour of lawn mowing can be is roughly equivalent to the amount of pollution produced by a car driven for 350 miles. So it's a pretty substantial impact in terms of climate change and also fossil fuel use that we see just in simple maintenance of lawns. Additionally, lawns use 10 times as many chemicals per acre as industrial farmland. 10 times is a pretty substantial number. And we're finding that in many parts of the world, municipalities are becoming, you know, quite concerned with this. And so much so that in Quebec, over 140 municipalities and the entire province have placed restrictions on the cosmetic use of synthetic lawn pesticides. In Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Kuwait, and Belize have placed restrictions on the use of the commonly used herbicide 2,4-D. So we all are at least relatively familiar with, you know, potential health concerns just with the overall use and application of pesticides and synthetic chemicals, both in terms of runoff and, you know, polluting surface waters, and as well as potential groundwater pollution.
So you're coming at the reasons for converting your lawn to a garden from environmental and public health point of view. Aren't there a lot of good reasons to do it in terms of just having a place to go on vacation every day right in your own house or in your own yard?
Definitely. That's an excellent point. And I think what's kind of a broad way of looking at this is kind of reassessing our relationship with our landscapes. And for many of us, the lawn has become the way that we interact with our yard and our property and nature. And I guess what we're starting to look at, too, then, is what does that say about our culture and about the type of communities that we want to create? We can very well make productive use of our property and still have a direct connection in maintaining that. But it becomes a much more of a cooperative relationship. In a very metaphorical sense, when we get on the lawnmower to maintain this, essentially an artificial ecosystem, we are motoring against natural processes, and we're creating work and pollution and all the other things that follow. So, instead we could be spending much of that time being productive and learning about nature and ecology and building really productive, beautiful habitats that provide us with food. They sequester carbon. They provide habitat for wildlife and certainly amenity in terms of beauty. So we can still have a lot of those same functions. And we're not necessarily bashing lawns, but saying that we need to look to finding more, productive or we should at least begin to consider how we can be more productive with our land use and develop a deeper relationship with it.
I was talking to a woman in Montpelier a week or two ago. She has a small lawn, garden in one corner of it, small garden, a small lawn. But she also has this chicken coop on wheels. And she's got two chickens in it, is planning on doubling her flock to four this year. And she wheels it around to different parts of the lawn. So the chickens fertilize the lawn. And I don't know if she plans to turn it into gardens to make use of that fertility. But she was talking about how wonderful that is for interacting with her neighbors, that kids come by and they want to see the chickens and hold the chickens, and sometimes she'll give them an egg to take home, and they get really excited about that. It's really been something that it's been a draw in the neighborhood and helped her start up lots of conversations with people. Do you find that gardens don't have anything quite as photogenic as squawking or clucking chickens necessarily, unless you have chickens in your garden, but if you have a purely vegetable garden is not quite as exciting as chickens, but do you find that people use gardens as a way to get to know their neighbors too?
Definitely. I mean, there's so many great potential networking and social opportunities that come up as a result of community gardens and just gardening amongst neighbors. We inevitably will have some sort of surplus, which helps just build networks between folks living in the same area, sharing additional produce. And then we might begin to find that if we're looking at fruit trees that require pollinators, that we have neighbors who are growing things that are complementary, so that we can begin to think about our neighborhood more as an ecosystem rather than our yards as islands. And I don't think anyone doesn't walk past a garden and just admire beautiful flowers or really healthy fresh produce. So just vegetable gardens and gardens in general are a way to help, people network and build community.
We're talking to Mark Krawczyk. He runs Keyline Vermont, a permaculture design and consulting business. The subject is lawns to gardens. And if you'd like to talk to him about this subject, the telephone number here is 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. And in just a moment, Mark, I'm going to ask you how you go about establishing a garden in an existing lawn. But for the moment, we're going to Berrytown, where we have Xenia on the phone. Hello, Xenia.
Good afternoon. Something that worked out to reduce the amount of grass I cut in my not very big lawn in my backyard is that taking all the branches that have fallen down from the trees, and had a couple of trees actually blow down, but just the branches that the willow trees and so forth drop, I have a sort of longish brush pile that I refer to as the hedge, and that's become beautiful bird habitat. It also provides extra privacy, and it shelters my perennial garden from the wind. Mm-hmm. The birds absolutely adore it, and I think I may have a woodchuck living there, and who knows what else. So it just sort of evolved by accident, but it also reduces the amount of grass that I cut, and also it has turned out to, I have a lot of volunteer trees now. Sort of, if you see things spring up and you mow around them, then pretty soon you have a bunch of trees. They're mostly locusts here, but some poplar. And this is just in a little tiny yard that's only not quite 3/10 of an acre.
Mm. How tall is
and
it?
It's,
how tall is
it's
the
less
brush
work
pile?
Than gardening.
Yeah. How tall is the brush pile, Xenia?
Oh, about 15 feet at this point.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds
had
like...
had a couple of big willow trees that drop a lot of branches.
Sounds like quite a lot of bird habitat there.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Yeah.
Yep. Mark, what do you think of bird habitat via brush pile hedges?
Yeah, well, I think it's a really clever use of an existing resource, one that people may often think of as being a waste product. And it's a great example of how we can begin to become, you know, better connected with what resources, you know, the land is actually offering us, and then being creative with what we how we use those. And one strategy that it sounds like Xenia is almost coincidentally mimicking also is that in Germany there was a traditional technique known as hügelkultur, where they would pile up windrows of brush, probably much smaller generally, only, you know, a couple feet high, and then fill that space in with soil and plant their potatoes directly into that. And that very loose, open, friable bed, you know, provided really ideal habitat for potato production and really healthy crops. So maybe not unknowingly, she's creating some form of hügelkultur.
Hmm. Well, for those of us who want to do something else, well, I guess what you're talking about is somewhere in between lawn to garden and just a strict brush pile. But for those of us who want to dig up a lawn and put in a vegetable garden, any tricks to it, or just dig it up and plant your tomato seeds?
To a certain extent. So the first thing I would recommend is safety. And what I would talk about are looking at this process as containing four steps. The first one being just to do some research. And maybe I'll just run, we were talking about research, design, what I'm going to call de-lawnify, lawn removal, and then planting, installation. So the first thing is that it's really important that we do some sort of soil test before we move in, especially in urban areas, and begin to plant. In many parts, I live in the Burlington area, lead is a significant issue. And we want to get an idea of whether or not that is contamination that we need to be concerned with. And so what one can do is contact the UVM Soil Testing Lab, where they currently, I believe, outsource the testing, but it's still possible to receive a soil test packet that you submit to them and get a soil test done. And they have an additional option. I believe it costs $10 or $12 for a general soil test, and then for an additional $10, you can have them test for heavy metals. And so, again, like I can't highlight that enough, that safety really should be our very first concern. We want to know what we're dealing with in the soil before we begin to plant. And I don't know that we'll necessarily have time today to get into some strategies that we can use as a response, because it depending on the level of contamination, there are different approaches we need to take. But it's certainly worth the time. And additionally, also, it's good to have an idea of what the mineral, the fertility, existing fertility is in the ground we're going to be planting into, because when we first establish the garden, it's a great chance to amend the soil so that it's going to produce healthier crops.
And I just went to the UVM Soil Test Lab site, which has not a very listener-friendly URL to it, but if you just type into a search engine, UVM Soil Test Lab, it comes right up. It says that the turnaround time for soil testing is 9 to 14 days, so something to be thinking about somewhat ahead of time before you get ready to do your planting.
Yeah, I'd say for folks that are interested in spring planting, as soon as you can get a shovel in the soil, it's good to take a test and submit that. And the testing kit will provide you with details on how to carry that test out properly. So just be sure to follow those instructions.
Now, the heavy metals option costs an extra $10, and I understand the precaution of wanting to do that if you're in an urban area, but what if you're out in a countryside in some old farmland or woodland that's been turned into a lawn plus a house on it or a housing development? Would you recommend soil tests there, too, for the heavy metals?
For myself, I still may do that because if I plan to be gardening somewhere for an extended period of time, the $10 up front is great peace of mind. Mm. But that said, the likelihood is quite low that there would be any concern in a rural area. Lead would be the only one generally, and if you're not near some sort of structure that may have been where that had been the subject of paint removal at some point in the recent past, there's a pretty good chance you're safe. But again, like you said, Carl, in urban areas, it's a different case, and I would generally suggest to do that.
So if you find that there's lead or some other heavy metal in your soil, then what do you do?
Sure. Well, there's a number of strategies, and what the simplest one is that people will often tend to do is build raised beds and then attempt to select plants that aren't going to be rooting as deep in the soil, higher up in the soil profile. So raised garden beds with rich compost mix, a rich compost mix with potting soil, are going to help get the feeder roots of the plants out of any potential contaminated soil. And so we're talking, when we say raised beds, between 6 to 8 inches, somewhere in that realm, but wider than a 2x4 as far as the overall height is what I would recommend. Another thing is that heavy metals tend to accumulate in the tissues of plants, but they usually aren't transferred into the fruits. So, for example, if you were growing food in contaminated soil knowingly, lettuces would be much more likely to accumulate any metals, whereas tomatoes would be a much safer crop. The metals don't tend to become available in the fruits. So fruits are generally much safer. And then if you have the option for a longer-term strategy, using bioremediation processes, plants that are recognized for uptake of heavy metals and contaminants is one strategy, but that will take several years in order to do that. So again, what it really comes down to is if you're concerned, do a test, and then respond to that accordingly. And I'd happily provide folks with any input that I personally can. They could contact me at burlingtonpermaculture@gmail.com.
That's burlingtonpermaculture@gmail.com.
Exactly.
And we're talking with Mark Krawczyk. He runs Keyline Vermont. And you're going to be giving a seminar on this whole lawn-to-garden process a week from today at the Kellogg Hubbard Library, correct?
Exactly, yeah. That's from 6:30 to 8:30 in Montpelier, and it's free. So it's being put on by the Transition Town Montpelier organization.
So 6:30 to 8:30 next Monday night in Montpelier. It's free. Come see Mark in person and get there 20 minutes early if you want to get a seat, if it's anything like what David Fried was talking about.
Exactly.
Okay, well, we're running out of time here, and we have 3 of the 4 more steps left to go. So why don't you quickly run us through those steps, Mark?
Sure. Well, basically, I won't say much about design, except it's good to have a clear idea of what it is that you'd like to get out of your garden.
And so, you know, it's really important to look at your site in relation to the larger whole, and then also do take some time and think really thoroughly about what it is you'd like your garden to produce, and then respond accordingly. So one of the things that we often tend to promote in permaculture are the planting of perennial and longer-term production crops, fruit trees and the like. And obviously those require a good deal of planning in order to make sure that they're placed in the right position, because you may be harvesting off of those for the rest of your life and beyond.
Mm.
So design is crucial. But the key here really is the lawn removal, Ben, as far as what, you know, we'll be covering in the workshop. And we have several options. And basically on one end that I would, you know, I kind of see these as existing on a continuum. Obviously, there's some sort of chemical herbicide, which is something I would strongly advise against for any number of reasons, of course. But then moving kind of slightly toward the other end of that continuum, tillage with a rototiller is one option folks might go for. But it tends to really disturb the soil structure. And what we tend to prefer in permaculture is to actually build soil in place, feeding the soil rather than the plant, and maintaining a really healthy layer of topsoil, and trying to build the biological activity. So the strategy I'm going to focus on in the workshop is called sheet mulching, or sheet composting, also known as lasagna gardening. And you could think of it basically as being a in-situ composting, where we actually...
That's in situ. You're using some fancy Latin term on us, right? In situ, in sight?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Exactly. Thank you. So generally we start off, there's basically two layers, or there can be a number of layers, but there's two main functions. There's a weed barrier, which folks generally will use newspaper or cardboard to basically just smother out the existing lawn. And you put down a thick layer of paper, or, you know, single sheets of cardboard that are well lapped, so that overlapped, so that the plants can't grow up in between those joints, and wet it really thoroughly. And if the lawn needed to be mowed, that's a good time to do it, and add any other amendments that you might want to build fertility. And then finally, add layers of organic matter on top of that. Say organic matter, I'm talking leaves, lawn clippings, coffee grounds, you know, food waste. We could be putting our you know, compost, unfinished compost on this early layer. People will often finish this with wood chips to be kind of a nice, heavy upper layer. And what happens is this stuff begins to break down in place. And so we're actually building soil, and we're building a really healthy, fertile habitat for the biology in the soil. And so this is a strategy of kind of production and regeneration, rather than, you know, dramatic destruction of you know, soil layers and soil health.
Hmm. Okay, well, we're about out of time there. Do you have any resources for us, Mark Krawczyk, that you'd care to recommend?
Definitely. The book Food Not Lawns, I can't place the author. I believe it's Heather Flores, and published by Chelsea Green, is an excellent resource on kind of the theory and practice of just replacing lawn with garden. And they run through a number of these processes one can use. Additionally, I'd recommend a book on sort of permaculture-inspired gardening by Toby Hemenway, and it's Gaia's Garden, also a Chelsea Green publication. And that also is very thorough and detailed in the context and steps for creating a healthy garden using these types of strategies, as well as looking at, you know, perennial and tree production in backyards. So those would be two of the resources I would point people to who are interested. And we'll definitely have more information for folks that come to any of those workshops. If for anyone that might be in the Burlington area tomorrow night at the Info Shop on 117 Bank Street in Burlington, we'll be doing another lawn to garden workshop from 6:30 to 8. So,
is that,
if you're
free
not in Montpelier,
too?
Sorry, go ahead, Carl.
Is that one free too, Mark?
That one is free. Yes.
Okay. Very good, Mark Krawczyk. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Carl.
Mark Krawczyk runs Keyline Vermont, a permaculture design and consulting business. He will be giving a workshop tomorrow night in Burlington at the Info Shop, 117 Bank Street, on converting lawns to gardens. That's free. It's 6:30 to 8 p.m. He'll be giving the same workshop with a little bit more generous time, 6:30 to 8:30, the Kellogg Hubbard Library in Montpelier. That's a week from today, Monday. And you can reach him at the email address burlingtonpermaculture@gmail.com. Next up, we'll be talking with George Schenk here in the studio. He's a founder and CEO of American Flatbread, and he'll talk about creating a new legal framework for Vermont food and how to make local food more affordable. We'll be back after this.